I'm Andy Bates, part of the team here at KFUO. While you hear me on the air and in podcasts, I'm also part of the team that works behind the scenes to bring you the programs like this that you value. What you hear on the air and in podcasts is just the tip of the iceberg. Listeners like you generously support everything that makes radio and podcasts happen. Administration, cutting-edge technology, software, hosts, producers, and more. You make this happen. Can we count on you to continue this support? KFUO Share-a-thon, now through April 5th, is a great time to show your support and make a gift or make a plan to give for a whole year. Your generosity is important and appreciated, not just by the KFUO team, but by listeners who get to hear and enjoy Christ-centered programs every day. Will you make a gift today? KFUO.org/give. KFUO.org/give.
You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
Thanks to Concordia University, Wisconsin for your support of The Coffee Hour. You can find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin at cuw.edu.
Live uncommon.
We are back to our history series today. It is always an exciting day to talk history with the Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thanks so much for joining us again today, Dr. McKenzie.
Well, I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So in our last episode, we covered a not so brief, but that's okay, history of Puritans in England. There's a lot happening there and the resulting separatist movement. And today we're moving into New England and the settlements that start to happen in New England. So the separatists were trying to leave for North America. How did that work out with this group?
Yeah, sure. The separatists, remember, they're the ones who can't stand the official church anymore. So they leave. It's illegal. So they actually do leave. And the first place they tried was the Netherlands, where it was okay. They were making a pretty good living. But they saw their children growing up and becoming very worldly by the standards of their standards in connection with their life in the Netherlands. Also, the Netherlands is about to go back to war with Spain, and that would not be a good situation. So they look for alternatives. They've been in the Netherlands for about 10 years, and they still have friends and people they knew in England. And so they set up a couple of their guys actually go back to England to meet with directors of the Virginia Trading Company. And after some period of negotiations, the separatist congregation in the Netherlands works out a deal whereby the Virginia Trading Company will ship them across the Atlantic to North America, and they will establish another settlement like Jamestown. They agree that they will acknowledge the royal supremacy so that they won't be, you know, illegal in that sense. But nonetheless, they're going to be far enough away that they'll be able to do their own thing anyway. Okay. Now, it's in September of 1620, that they leave, and their place of disembarkation was Plymouth in England. And of course, probably your listeners know that the name of the ship upon which they sailed was the Mayflower. There were about 100 people on the Mayflower. Only about 40 of them were actually from the Leiden separatist congregation, and they constituted only about half of the membership of their congregation. The other half, including their pastor, John Robinson, stayed in the Netherlands just to see if this New England colonial expedition was going to work. Well, they reached New England at precisely the wrong time of year. It was winter, and after trying one place or another, they finally settled on a place that they called Plymouth, part of today's Massachusetts, and disembarked to establish a place to live on December 26th of 1620. Now, it turned out that they were settling in a place that was outside of the territory that had been assigned to the Virginia Trading Company. So they weren't settling in like Virginia, conceived very largely. They weren't in Virginia. They were in, it was still claimed by the King of England, but it wasn't claimed by any trading company. And so that's why they had to establish a government for themselves. And, you know, in American constitutional history, they wrote up a small document called the Mayflower Compact, and everybody on board ship signed it. And it was really small provisions, a small document for self-government. So that in itself was interesting, although we don't worry about it too much from the standpoint of religion. So they now have their place in which they can worship God according to their own lights, and they won't have to worry about worldly models from the Dutch. But they don't have a pastor, but they have an elder, and this is William Brewster. He's their spiritual head. He was the only one in their group who had any kind of university training. And as I said, he'd been chosen as their elder back actually in England to begin with. But he wasn't a pastor. And they did not consider him their pastor. They thought of themselves as a part of that Leyden congregation, and John Robinson was their pastor. So Brewster would conduct services. He led the prayers. He preached twice every Sunday. He counseled, and he, along with other elders, disciplined the members, but he did not administer the sacraments. He was not a pastor. In 1623, after they had written back to Pastor Robinson about what they should do, Robinson said no to Brewster's request regarding permission to administer the sacraments. Brewster had not been chosen as a teaching or preaching elder. He had been chosen as a ruling elder, and that meant that he was not supposed to administer the sacraments. Robinson said he wasn't learned. Now, he had gone to university, but he hadn't studied theology, he hadn't studied biblical languages, so he was not qualified. Now, Robinson died in 1625 and never did come to New England or Plymouth. At one point, that London, Virginia Trading Company did send an Anglican clergyman by the name of John Lyford to Plymouth. This was 1624, but for some reason or other, he didn't work out, so they sent him packing, and so they continued to be without a clergyman, and that meant without the sacraments. Only in 1629 did Ralph Smith, a clergyman who had been serving in Salem in Massachusetts, and that's another little story maybe we'll get into, he came, and he was finally accepted as their permanent pastor, and so Plymouth finally could have a full preaching and sacramental ministry in their midst. So that's how they got settled, and that's the kind of church that they established. They are the first and therefore an important milestone in the development of American, or New England especially, Protestant religion. As a colony, they were first experiment in self-government. So they have lots of significance as being first, but they were not really an important or influential colony when it came to religion. The colony did not attract theologians. It did not have much influence upon the development of New England theology. It grew very slowly. After 10 years, 1630, they had a total population of only about 300. After 25 years, they only had 2,500. And then in 1691, when they were finally merged with Massachusetts Bay to become the Royal Colony of Massachusetts, they still only had about 7,500 people. So they didn't have a lot of influence. Now, there's one exception to that, and that, of course, is our Thanksgiving Day holiday. They have been influential in that respect. So let me do a little parenthesis here on Thanksgiving. One of the characteristics of the Puritan movement that we talk about was the fact that they wanted to follow the Bible very strictly. And as they read the scriptures, God had set up humanity's time schedule really by the week. 7 days, and out of the 7 days, six were for work, and one was for rest and religion. Like the early Christians, they had moved that day for rest and religion from Saturday to Sunday as an observance of our Lord's resurrection. So the one day upon which you were not supposed to work, but instead were to go to church and devote yourself to physical rest and religion, prayer, meditation, and so forth, was Sunday. Other than that, work. And that meant no other holidays, no Christmas, no Ash Wednesday, Good Friday, nothing except 6 days of work and then Sunday, 6 days of work and then Sunday. However, modeling themselves after both the Old Testament and then what our Lord had said about prayer, fasting, and thanksgiving, they did recognize days of thanksgiving when God had blessed them extraordinarily, as well as days of humiliation and fasting. And such days could be and were proclaimed in response to things like drought or flood, plague, military defeat. So in this form of Protestant religion, of which the New England settlers, starting with Plymouth, were a part, they had these days of humiliation and fasting and these days of thanksgiving. So a day of thanksgiving would be held in response to signs of God's extraordinary blessing and mercy. Well, in the fall of 1621, they had a bountiful harvest, and they decided to have a day of thanksgiving. After, you know, their first year was kind of miserable. Lots of sickness, lots of scarcity, lots of death. But by the fall of 1621, they'd had a good harvest. And so the pilgrims in Plymouth, I haven't been calling them pilgrims, but that's their name in the history books, had a day of thanksgiving. And one of the contemporaries described their celebration this way: "Our harvest being gotten in, our governor sent 4 men on fowling, that we might, after a more special manner, rejoice together after we had gathered in the fruits of our labors. They 4 in one day killed as much fowl as with a little help besides served the company almost a week. At which time, amongst other recreations, we exercised our arms, many of the Indians coming amongst us, and among the rest, their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted, and they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation and bestowed on our governor and upon the captain and others. And although it be not always so plentiful as it was at this time with us, yet by the goodness of God, we are so far from want that we often wish you, back in Old England, partakers of our plenty." So that was the first Thanksgiving. But I don't want anybody to think that's the only time they had days of Thanksgiving, because they had others. And then they also had these days of humiliation and prayer.
We'll take a pause there, and then we'll pick up more with the separatists in New England in just a moment. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
At Concordia University, Wisconsin, we believe you were created for a reason: to use your God-given gifts to help others, to live a life of self-sacrifice in a me-first world, to live a life that's uncommon. Whether you're taking one of 50-plus online programs or learning with us in person on the shores of Lake Michigan, you'll be equipped to make an uncommon impact. Learn more at cuw.edu. Concordia University, Wisconsin. Live uncommon.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Andy Bates.
I'm Sarah Golseth.
Today we're talking with Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Seminary, Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We are taking a look at the history of the Puritans And now the separatists, now we're starting to call them pilgrims, and the founding of New England. Dr. McKenzie, we just left off with Thanksgiving, at this time of Thanksgiving that the pilgrims or the separatists had established. Where do you want to pick up from there?
I'm just going to end it off pretty quickly here. I just want to mention that we have actually a pretty nice firsthand account of this congregation and their settlement in New England from William Bradford. Besides Brewster, Bradford is the most prominent of those first pilgrim settlers. He became governor. He's the second governor, but the first governor of Plymouth died during the first winter. So basically, Bradford was there from the beginning, and he held the post of governor until his death in 1657, so from 1620, so 37 years. And he wrote a history of New England. It's called The History of Plymouth Plantation. The last time I looked, it was still in print. If it's not in print, it's probably available anywhere on the internet. And again, his name is William Bradford. So anybody who's interested in a firsthand account of these events, Bradford would be the place to go. So that's what I wanted to say to finish off our discussion of the first of the New England religious settlements, Plymouth Plantation. Now we need to get into the Puritan colonies. All set?
Yeah, let's do that. And I think, are you going to get into the difference between the Pilgrims and the Puritans here? I'm not sure that we've actually covered that difference yet.
Yeah, okay.
Perfect.
The Pilgrims are the separatists, and the separatists belong to the large group of Christians, Protestant Christians in England, unhappy with the established church. So the separatists and the ones we're calling Puritans overlap quite a little bit in terms of their criticism of the establishment. But what makes them different and significant is that the Puritans, who are the much larger group, more important group, the ones who established Boston, Connecticut, etc., they stay in the established church. They don't leave. And whereas the separatists leave, and you know, the separatists will criticize the Puritans as being hypocrites for staying in, and the Puritans will criticize the separatists as quitters giving up the fight. So in spite of the fact there are a lot of things that they will agree on theologically, nonetheless, there's not going to be a lot of love lost between these two groups. So the separatists, much smaller in number, really not nearly so influential as you might think, but they do have the distinction of being the first to get over to this side of the Atlantic and establish a religious colony in New England. But now we have to go back and talk about the Puritans who don't separate, the Puritans who don't separate. And they're kind of an interesting bunch. Under James I, there were lots of things that bothered the Puritan wing of the Church of England. They didn't get anything by way of concessions at Hampton Court. We talked about that the other day. They had this big meeting. They raised all their concerns. James said, "You're right, we need a better Bible." He gave him a better Bible. But everything else, he said, "No, we're not giving in." James bothered a lot of them on account of his vacillating attitude toward the Catholics. James wanted to get along with the Catholics. He was willing to give them large measures of religious liberty if they would acknowledge the king's authority and would not accept overseas orders from the Pope. He would have given them a large measure of religious liberty. And this really bothered the Puritans. You know, they thought if we let Catholics worship publicly, we'll be calling upon down God's wrath upon England for putting up with this terrible form of Christianity just one step removed from idolatry. So they didn't like that. In foreign policy, this is the time the 30 Years' War is going on, and it's Protestants versus Catholics, and James is trying to get closer relations with Spain, and Spain was the epitome of a Catholic country, and that was concern to them. James was even trying to work out a marriage alliance between his son and a Spanish princess. And so again, this really concerns these folks. And then there is the terrible corruption and immorality at court. It was a very bad scene. You've got open fornication, divorce, worldly dress and amusements, dances, plays, balls, all kinds of things that the Puritans objected to. And then there was Sunday observance. These folks said, nothing going on Sunday except church and then staying home to pray and meditate. James actually published a book of amusement for Sundays, a book of sports it was called. And in it, he outlined the kinds of things which he thought you should do on Sundays. And these included things like May games and Morris dances, traditional amusements often marked by excesses and drinking and tomfoolery. And so James is on board with this. And he even orders the clergy to read the Book of Sports from their pulpits. So the Puritans have lots of stuff that they didn't like about James, and yet they stayed in. So the big question is, why did these folks stay in and not become Puritans? Well, for one thing, they have a lot of influence in the church. They maybe couldn't get changes, but a lot of them were important pastors, were professors, teachers at the universities. One of the colleges at Cambridge was cranking out Puritan clergy all during these years. The Church of England officials that were supposed to enforce the rules, like reading the Book of Sports, like conforming to the Book of Common Prayer, they weren't all that eager to make trouble for themselves. The Archbishop of Canterbury, a fellow by the name of George Abbott, he was a pretty good Protestant, and he did not rigorously enforce the regulations that the Puritans found so uncomfortable. So that was good. And then, too, there was James's decision to participate in the Synod of Dort. The Synod of Dort was this big meeting of Reformed clergy in the Netherlands to settle how Calvinist the church was going to be. And it was out of the Synod of Dort that something called five-point Calvinism comes. And it's the extreme form of Calvinism. Some of your listeners might remember the TULIP acronym. Belief in the total depravity of human nature, the unconditional election, double predestination, the limited atonement, Jesus died only for the elect, irresistible grace, if you're one of the elect, you're one of the elect, and the preservation of the saints, you'll never fall. Now that comes out of the Synod of Dort, and here's the important thing. James sent representatives to the Synod of Dort, the Church of England was represented there, and they signed off on TULIP. So TULIP became kind of the official theology of the Church of England through participation in the Synod of Dort. So, you know, Puritans aren't losing everything, and they're feeling good about that. And then there are some prominent Puritan preachers who are favorites of some of the court officials. So it's not like everything was lost. And I should mention that two more practical things. One was just the biblical teaching that every soul ought to be subject to the higher powers, the Romans 13 argument. And the Reform followed that. They thought, well, this is our government. This is our king. We should be obedient to him as much as we can. And if he's not enforcing all of this stuff, that's okay. And then, as I said the other day about separatism, separation from the church, it is almost like seditious. It's like saying, you know, you guys are all going to hell. This is an apostate nation. We don't want anything to do with you. And they didn't feel that way. I mean, many of them, as I said, had important positions in England and in the church. So they're not ready to take that kind of step, even though there are lots of things about James and his court that bothered them. Now, all this changes when James dies and he is succeeded by his son, Charles I. It all changes. And I'll just mention one little thing here to whet your appetite for the next program. Among other things, Charles I marries a French princess. She is not only Catholic, but by the terms of the marriage treaty, she can bring over a Catholic chaplain, Catholic priest. And so we set up right in the royal household, kind of a Catholic chapel. And some of the prominent English who wanted to curry favor with the monarch, well, their wives started going to the Catholic chapel of the queen. So things are going to change for the worse as far as the Puritans are concerned. And some of them, at least, are going to get out of town. So we'll talk more about that next time.
Yes, this will be an interesting story to pick up in our next episode. Reverend Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thanks so much for being our guest today on the Coffee Hour.
Well, I'm happy to do so. Look forward to next time.
You've been listening to the Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
I'm Andy Bates.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support the Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.